Will future ages believe that such stupid bigotry ever existed? Said Bois Guilbert, striding up and down the apartment. What they may believe, I know not, said Malvoisin calmly, but I know well that in this our day clergy and laymen, take 99 to 100, will cry Amen to the Grand Master's sentence. I have it, said Bois Guilbert. Albert, thou art my friend. Thou must connive at her escape, Malvoisin, and I will transport her to some place of greater security and secrecy. I cannot, if I would, replied the preceptor. The mansion is filled with the attendants of the Grand Master and others who are devoted to him. And to be frank with you, brother, I would not embark with you in this matter, even if I could hope to bring my bark to haven. I have risked enough already for your sake. I have no mind to encounter the risk of degradation, or even to lose my preceptory for the sake of a painted piece of Jewish flesh and blood. And you, if you will be guided by my counsel, will give up this wild goose chase and fly your hawk at some other game. Think, Bois Guilbert, thy present rank, thy future honours, all depend on thy place in the order. Shouldst thou adhere perversely to thy passion for this Rebecca, thou wilt give Beaumanoir the power of expelling thee, and he will not neglect it. He is jealous of the truncheon which he holds in his trembling gripe, and he knows thou stretchest thy bold hand towards it. Doubt not he will ruin thee if thou affordest him a pretext so fair as thy protection of a Jewish sorceress. Give him his scope in this matter, for thou canst not control him. When the staff is in thine own firm grasp, thou mayest caress the daughters of Judah, or burn them, as may best suit thine own humour. Malvoisin, said Bois Guilbert, thou art a cold-blooded friend, said the preceptor, hastening to fill up the blank, in which Bois Guilbert would probably have placed a worse word. A cold-blooded friend I am, and therefore more fit to give thee advice. I tell thee once more that thou canst not save Rebecca. I tell thee once more thou canst but perish with her. Go hie thee to the Grand Master, throw thyself at his feet, and tell him not at his feet, by heaven, but to the dotard's very beard will I say. Say to him then, to his beard, continued Malvoisin coolly, that you love this captive Jewess to distraction. And the more thou dost enlarge on thy passion, the greater will be his haste to end it by the death of the fair enchantress. While thou, taken in flagrant delict, in the avowal of a crime contrary to thine oath, canst hope no aid of thy brethren, and must exchange all thy brilliant visions of ambition and power to lift perhaps a mercenary spear in some of the petty quarrels between Flanders and Burgundy. Thou speakest the truth, Malvoisin, said Brian de Bois Guilbert, after a moment's reflection. I will give the hoary bigots no advantage over me. And for Rebecca, she hath not merited at my hand that I should expose rank and honour for her sake. I will cast her off. Yes, I will leave her to her fate, unless qualify not thy wise and necessary resolution, said Malvoisin. Women are but the toys which amuse our lighter hours. Ambition is the serious business of life. Perish 1,000 such frail baubles as this Jewess before thy manly step pause in the brilliant course which is stretched before thee. For the present we part, nor must we be seen to hold close communication. I must order the hall for his judgment seat. What? Said Bois Guilbert. So soon? Aye, replied the preceptor, trial moves speedily on when the judge has predetermined the sentence. Rebecca, said Bois Guilbert, when he was left alone, thou art like to cost me dear. Why cannot I abandon thee to thy fate as this calm hypocrite recommends? One effort will I make to save thee, but beware of ingratitude. For if I am again repulsed, my vengeance shall equal my love. The life and honour of Bois Guilbert must not be hazarded, where contempt and reproaches are his only reward. The preceptor had hardly given the necessary orders when he was joined by Conrad Mountfitchet, who acquainted him with the Grand Master's resolution to bring the Jewess to instant trial for sorcery. "It is surely a dream," said the preceptor. "We have many Jewish physicians, and we call them not wizards, though they work wonderful cures." "The Grand Master thinks otherwise," said Mount Fitchett. "And, Albert, I will be upright with thee. Wizard or not, it were better this miserable damsel die than that Brian de Bois-Guilbert should be lost to the order, or the order divided by internal dissension. Thou knowest his high rank, his fame in arms, thou knowest the zeal with which many of our brethren regard him, but all this will not avail him with our Grand Master, should he consider Brian as the accomplice, not the victim, of this Jewess. Were the souls of the 12 tribes in her single body, it were better she suffered alone than that Bois-Guilbert were partner in her destruction." "I have been working him even now to abandon her," said Malvoisin. "But still, are there grounds enough to condemn this Rebecca for sorcery? Will not the Grand Master change his mind when he sees that the proofs are so weak?" "They must be strengthened, Albert," replied Mount Fitchett. "Dost thou understand me? They must be strengthened. The good of the order requires her death, and the honour of the Grand Master must be preserved. He must not appear to decide on slight grounds. Dost thou understand me?"
"I do," said the preceptor. "Nor do I scruple to do aught for advancement of the order. But there is little time to find engines fitting."
"Malvoisin, they must be found," said Conrad. "Well will it advantage both the order and thee."
"This temple stow is a poor preceptory. That of Maison Dieu is worth double its value. Thou knowest my interest with our old chief. Find those who can carry this matter through, and thou art preceptor of Maison Dieu in the fertile Kent. How sayest thou?"
"There is," replied Malvoisin, "among those who come hither with Bois-Guilbert, two fellows whom I well know. Servants they were to my brother Philippe de Malvoisin, and passed from his service to that of Front de Boeuf. It may be they know something of the witcheries of this woman."
"Away, seek them out instantly, and hark thee, if a besant or two will sharpen their memory, let it not be wanting.
They would swear the mother that bore them a sorceress for a zecchin," said the preceptor.
"Away, then," said Mount Fitchett.
"At noon the affair will proceed. I have not seen our senior in such earnest preparation since he condemned to the stake Hamet Al-Faghi, a convert who relapsed to the Moslem faith."
The ponderous castle bell had tolled the point of noon when Rebecca heard a trampling of feet upon the private stair which led to her place of confinement. The noise announced the arrival of several persons, and the circumstance rather gave her joy, for she was more afraid of the solitary visits of the fierce and passionate Bois-Guilbert than of any evil which could befall her besides. The door of the chamber was unlocked, and Conrad, with the preceptor Albert Malvoisin, entered, attended by four warders clothed in black and bearing halberds.
"Daughter of an accursed race," said the preceptor, "arise and follow us."
"Whither?" said Rebecca. "And for what purpose?"
"Damsel," answered Conrad, "it is not for thee to question, but to obey. Nevertheless, be it known to thee that thou art to be brought before the tribunal of the Grand Master of our holy order, there to answer for thine offences."
"May the God of Abraham be praised," said Rebecca, folding her hands devoutly. "The name of a judge, though an enemy to my people, is to me as the name of a protector. Most willingly do I follow thee. Permit me only to wrap my veil around my head."
They descended the stair with slow and solemn step, traversed a long gallery, and, by a folding pair of doors placed at the end, entered the great hall in which the Grand Master had for the time established his court of justice. The lower part of this ample apartment was filled with squires and yeomen, who made way not without some difficulty for Rebecca, attended by the preceptor and Mount Fitchett, and followed by the guard of halberdiers, to move forward to the seat appointed for her. As she passed through the crowd, her arms folded and her head depressed, a scrap of paper was thrust into her hand, which she received almost unconsciously, and continued to hold without examining its contents. The assurance that she possessed some friend in this awful assembly gave her courage to look around and to mark into whose presence she had been conducted. She gazed accordingly upon the scene which we shall endeavour to describe in our next chapter. Chapter 7. Stern was the law which bade its votaries leave at human woes with human hearts to grieve. Stern was the law which, at the winning while of frank and harmless mirth, forbade to smile, but sterner still, when high the iron rod of tyrant power she shook, and called that power of God. The Middle Ages. The tribunal, erected for the trial of the innocent and unhappy Rebecca, occupied the dais or elevated part of the upper end of the great hall, a platform which we have already described as the place of honour destined to be occupied by the most distinguished inhabitants or guests of an ancient mansion. On an elevated seat, directly before the accused, sat the Grand Master of the Temple, in full and ample robes of flowing white, holding in his hand the mystic staff which bore the symbol of the order. At his feet was placed a table, occupied by two scribes, chaplains of the order, whose duty it was to reduce to formal record the proceedings of the day. The black dresses, bare scalps, and demure looks of these churchmen formed a strong contrast to the warlike appearance of the knights who attended, either as residing in the preceptory or as come thither to attend it upon their grand master. The preceptors, of whom there were four present, occupied seats lower in height and somewhat drawn back behind that of their superior, and the knights, who enjoyed no such rank in the order, were placed on benches still lower, and preserving the same distance from the preceptors as these from the Grand Master. Behind them, but still upon the dais or elevated portion of the hall, stood the esquires of the order in white dresses of an inferior quality. The whole assembly wore an aspect of the most profound gravity, and in the aspect of the knights might be perceived traces of military daring united with the solemn carriage becoming men of religious profession, and which in the presence of their grand master failed not to sit upon every brow. The remaining and lower part of the hall was filled with guards holding partisans, and with other attendants whom curiosity had drawn thither to see at once a grand master and a Jewish sorceress. By far the greater part of these inferior persons were, in one rank or other, connected with the order, and were accordingly distinguished by their black dresses. But peasants from the neighbouring country were not refused admittance, for it was the pride of Beaumanoir to render the edifying spectacle of the justice which he administered as public as possible. His large blue eyes seemed to expand as he gazed around the assembly, and his countenance appeared dilated by the conscious dignity and imaginary merit of the part which he was about to perform. A psalm, which he himself accompanied with a deep, mellow voice, which age had not deprived of its powers, commenced the proceedings of the day, and the solemn sounds, Venite exultemus Domino, so often sung by the Templars before engaging with earthly adversaries, was judged by Luca most appropriate to introduce the approaching triumph, for such he deemed it, over the powers of darkness. The long, prolonged notes, raised by 100 masculine voices accustomed to combine in the choral chant, rose to the vaulted roof of the hall and rolled on amongst its arches with the pleasing yet solemn sound of the rushing of mighty waters. When the sounds ceased, the Grand Master turned his eyes slowly round the circle and observed that the seat of one of the preceptors was vacant. Brian de Bois-Guilbert, by whom it had been occupied, had left his place and was now standing near the extreme corner of one of the benches occupied by the Knights Companions of the Temple, one hand extending his long mantle so as in some degree to hide his face, while the other held his cross-handled sword, with the point of which, sheathed as it was, he was slowly drawing lines upon the oaken floor. "Unhappy man," said the Grand Master, after favouring him with a glance of compassion. "Thou seest, Conrad, how this holy work distresses him. To this can the light look of woman, aided by the prince of the powers of this world, bring a valiant and worthy knight. Seest thou, he cannot look upon us, he cannot look upon her, and who knows by what impulse from his tormentors his hand forms these cabalistic lines upon the floor. It may be our life and safety are thus aimed at, but we spit and defy the foul enemy. Semper Leo percutiatur." This was communicated apart to his confidential follower, Conrad Mountfitchet. The Grand Master then raised his voice and addressed the assembly. "Reverend and valiant men, knights, preceptors and companions of this holy order, my brethren and my children, you also, well-born and pious esquires who aspire to wear this holy cross, and you also, Christian brethren of every degree, be it known to you that it is not defect of power in us which hath occasioned the assembling of this congregation. For to us, however unworthy in our person, yet still to us is committed, with this baton, full power to judge and to try all that regards the weal of this our holy order. Holy Saint Bernard, in the rule of our knightly and religious profession, hath said, in the 59th capital, that he would not that brethren be called to assemble in council, save at the will and command of the Master, leaving it free to us, as to those more worthy fathers who have preceded us in this our office, to judge as well of the occasion as of the time and place in which a chapter of the whole order, or of any part thereof, may be convoked. Also, in all such chapters, it is our duty to hear the advice of our brethren, and to proceed according to our own pleasure. But when the raging wolf hath made an inroad upon the flock, and carried off one member thereof, it is the duty of the head shepherd to call his comrades together, that with bows and slings they may quell the invader, according to our well-known rule that the lion is ever to be beaten down. We have, therefore, summoned to our presence a Jewish woman by name Rebecca, daughter of Isaac of York, a woman infamous for sortileges and for witcheries, wherewith she hath maddened the blood and besotted the brain, not of a churl, but of a knight, not of a secular knight, but of one devoted to the service of the holy temple, not of a knight companion, but of a preceptor of our order, first in honour as in place. Our brother Brian de Bois-Guilbert is well known to ourselves, and to all degrees who now hear me, as a true and zealous champion of the cross, by whose arm many deeds of valour have been wrought in the Holy Land, and the holy places purified from pollution by the blood of those infidels who defiled them. Neither have our brother's sagacity and prudence been less patent to his brethren than his valour and discipline, insomuch that knights, both in eastern and western lands, have named Dubois-Guilbert as one who may well be put in nomination as successor to this baton, when it shall please heaven to release us from the toil of bearing it. If we were told that such a man, so honoured and so honourable, suddenly casting away regard for his character, his vows, his brethren, and his prospects, had associated to himself a Jewish damsel, wandered in this lewd company through solitary places, defended her person in preference to his own, and finally was so utterly blinded and besotted by his folly as to bring her even to one of our own preceptories, what should we say but that the noble knight was possessed by some evil demon, or influenced by some wicked spell? If we could suppose it otherwise, think not rank, valour, high repute, or any earthly consideration should prevent us from visiting him with punishment, that the evil thing might be removed, even according to the text, auferti malum ex vobis. For various and heinous are the acts of transgression against the rule of our blessed order in this lamentable history. First, he hath walked according to his proper will, contrary to capital 33, quo nullus juxta propriam voluntatum incedat,
Second, he hath held commune with an excommunicated person, capital 57, ut fratres non participent cum excommunicatis, and hath therefore a portion in anathema maranatha. Third, he hath consorted with strange women, contrary to the capital, ut fratres non versantur cum extraniis mulieribus. Fourth, he hath not avoided, nay, he hath, it is to be feared, solicited the kiss of woman, by which, saith the last rule of our renowned order, ut fugiantur oscula, the soldiers of the cross are brought into a snare. For which heinous and multiplied guilt, Brion de Bois-Guilbert should be cut off and cast out from our congregation, were he the right hand and right eye thereof. He paused. A low murmur went through the assembly. Some of the younger part, who had been inclined to smile at the statute De Osculis Fugiendis, became now grave enough and anxiously waited what the Grand Master was next to propose. Such, he said, and so great should indeed be the punishment of a Knight Templar who wilfully offended against the rules of his order in such weighty points. But if, by means of charms and of spells, Satan had obtained dominion over the knight, perchance because he cast his eyes too lightly upon a damsel's beauty, we are then rather to lament than chastise his backsliding, and, imposing on him only such penance as may purify him from his iniquity, we are to turn the full edge of our indignation upon the accursed instrument, which had so nigh occasioned his utter falling away. Stand forth, therefore, and bear witness, ye who have witnessed these unhappy doings, that we may judge of the form and bearing thereof, and whether our justice may be satisfied with the punishment of this infidel woman, or must proceed with a bleeding heart to the further proceeding against our brother.
Several witnesses were called upon to prove the risks to which Bois-Guilbert exposed himself in endeavouring to save Rebecca from the blazing castle, and his neglect of his personal defence in attending to her safety. The men gave these details with the exaggerations common to vulgar minds which have been strongly excited by any remarkable event, and their natural disposition to the marvellous was increased greatly by the satisfaction which their evidence seemed to afford to the eminent person for whose information it had been delivered. Thus, the dangers which Bois-Guilbert surmounted, in themselves sufficiently great, became portentous in their narrative. The devotion of the knight to Rebecca's defence was exaggerated beyond the bounds not only of discretion, but even of the most frantic excess of chivalrous zeal, and his deference to what she said, though her language was often severe and upbraiding, was painted as carried to an excess, which, in a man of his haughty temper, seemed well-nigh preternatural. The preceptor of Templestowe was then called upon to describe the manner in which Bois-Guilbert and the Jewess arrived at the preceptory. The evidence of Malvoisin was skilfully guarded, but while he apparently studied to spare the feelings of Bois-Guilbert, he threw in from time to time such hints as seemed to infer that he laboured under some temporary alienation of the mind, so deeply did he appear to be enamoured of the damsel whom he brought along with him. With sighs of penitence, the preceptor avowed his own contrition for having admitted Rebecca and her lover within the walls of his preceptory. "But my defence," he concluded, "has been made in my confession to our most reverend father, the Grand Master. He knows my motives were not evil, though my conduct may have been irregular. Joyfully will I submit to any penance he shall assign me."
"Thou hast spoken well, Brother Albert," said Beaumanoir. "Thy motives were good, since thou didst judge it right to stop thine erring brother in his career of precipitate folly. But thy conduct was wrong, as he who would stop a runaway steed, and seizing him by the stirrup in place of the bridle, receives injury himself instead of accomplishing his purpose. 13 paternosters are assigned by our pious founder for matins, and 9 for vespers. Be those services doubled by thee. Thrice a week are Templars permitted the use of flesh, but do thou keep fast for all the 7 days. This do for 6 months to come, and thy penance is accomplished."
With a hypocritical look of the deepest submission, the preceptor of Templestowe bowed to the ground before his superior and resumed his seat.
"Were it not well, brethren," said the Grand Master, "that we examine something into the life and conversation of this woman, specially that we may discover whether she be one like to use magical charms and spells, since the truths which we have heard may well incline us to suppose that in this unhappy course our erring brother has been acted upon by some infernal enticement and delusion."
Herman of Goodalricke was the fourth preceptor present. The other three were Conrad, Malvoisin, and Bois Guilbert himself. Herman was an ancient warrior whose face was marked with the scars inflicted by the sabres of the Muslimar, and had great rank and consideration among his brethren. He arose and bowed to the Grand Master, who instantly granted him license of speech.
"I would crave to know, most reverend father, of our valiant brother, Brian de Bois Guilbert, what he says to these wondrous accusations, and with what eye he himself now regards his unhappy intercourse with this Jewish maiden."
"Brian de Bois Guilbert," said the Grand Master, "thou hearest the question which our brother of Goodalricke desireth thou shouldest answer. I command thee to reply to him."
Bois Guilbert turned his head towards the Grand Master when thus addressed, but remained silent.
"He is possessed by a dumb devil," said the Grand Master.
"Avoid thee, Sathalas! Speak, Brian de Bois Guilbert, I conjure thee, by this symbol of our holy order."
Bois Guilbert made an effort to suppress his rising scorn and indignation, the expression of which he knew well would little here avail him.
"Brian de Bois Guilbert," he answered,
"replies not, most reverend father, to such wild and vague charges. If his honour be impeached, he will defend it with his body, and with that sword which has often fought for Christendom."
"We forgive thee, brother Brian," said the Grand Master. "That thou hast boasted thy warlike achievements before us is a glorifying of thine own deeds, and cometh of the enemy, who tempteth us to exalt our own worship. But thou hast our pardon, judging thou speakest less of thine own suggestion than from the impulse of him whom, by heaven's leave, we will quell and drive forth from our assembly."
A glance of disdain flashed from the dark, fierce eyes of Bois Guilbert, but he made no reply.
"And now," pursued the Grand Master, "since our brother of Goodalricke's question has been thus imperfectly answered, pursue we our quest, brethren, and with our patron's assistance, we will search to the bottom this mystery of iniquity. Let those who have aught to witness of the life and conversation of this Jewish woman stand forth before us."
There was a bustle in the lower part of the hall, and when the Grand Master inquired the reason, it was replied that there was in the crowd a bedridden man whom the prisoner had restored to the perfect use of his limbs by a miraculous balsam. The poor peasant, a Saxon by birth, was dragged forward to the bar, terrified at the penal consequences which he might have incurred by the guilt of having been cured of the palsy by a Jewish damsel. Perfectly cured he certainly was not, for he dragged himself forward on crutches to give evidence. Most unwilling was his testimony, and given with many tears, but he admitted that 2 years since, when residing at York, he was suddenly afflicted with a sore disease while labouring for Isaac the rich Jew in his vocation of a joiner, that he had been unable to stir from his bed until the remedies applied by Rebecca's directions, and specially a warming and spicy-smelling balsam, had in some degree restored him to health. Moreover, he said she had given him a pot of that precious unguent, and furnished him with a piece of money withal, to return to the house of his father, near to Templestowe.
"And may it please your gracious reverence," said the man, "I cannot think that the damsel meant harm by me, though she hath the ill hap to be a Jewess, for ever when I used her remedy, I said the Pater and the Creed, and it never operated a whit less kindly.
Peace, slave, said the Grand Master, and be gone. It well suits brutes like thee to be tampering and trinketing with hellish cures, and to be giving your labour to the sons of misbelief. I tell thee, the fiend can impose diseases for the very purpose of removing them, in order to bring into credit some diabolical fashion of cure. Hast thou that unguent of which thou spokest?
The peasant, fumbling in his bosom with a trembling hand, produced a small box, bearing some Hebrew characters on the lid, which was, with most of the audience, a sure proof that the devil had stood apothecary. Beaumanoir, after crossing himself, took the box into his hand, and, learned in most of the Eastern tongues, read with ease the motto on the lid, "The lion of the tribe of Judah hath conquered."
"Strange powers of Satanas," he said, "which can convert scripture into blasphemy, mingling poison with our most necessary food. Is there no leech here who can tell us the ingredients of this mystic unguent?"
Two mediciners, as they termed themselves, the one a monk, the other a barber, appeared, and avouched they knew nothing of the materials, excepting that they savoured of myrrh and camphire, oriental herbs. But with true professional hatred to a successful practitioner of their art, they insinuated that, since the medicine was beyond their own knowledge, it must necessarily have been compounded from an unlawful and magical pharmacopoeia, since they themselves, though no conjurers, fully understood every branch of their art, so far as it might be exercised with the good faith of a Christian. When this medical research was ended, the Saxon peasant desired humbly to have back the medicine which he had found so salutary, but the Grand Master frowned severely at the request.
"What is thy name, fellow?" said he to the cripple.
"Hig, the son of Snell," answered the peasant.
"Then, Hig, son of Snell," said the Grand Master, "I tell thee it is better to be bedridden than to accept the benefits of unbelievers that thou mayest arise and walk. Better to despoil infidels of their treasure by the strong hand than to accept of their benevolence gifts, or to do them service for wages. Go thou, and do as I have said."
"Alack," said the peasant, "and it shall not displease your reverence. The lesson comes too late for me, for I am but a maimed man. But I will tell my two brethren, who serve the rich rabbi Nathan ben Samuel, that your mastership says it is more lawful to rob him than to render him faithful service."
"Out with the prating villain," said Beaumanoir, who was not prepared to refute this practical application of his general maxim.
Hig, the son of Snell, withdrew into the crowd, but, interested in the fate of his benefactress, lingered until he should learn her doom, even at the risk of again encountering the frown of that severe judge, the terror of which withered his very heart within him. At this period of the trial, the Grand Master commanded Rebecca to unveil herself. Opening her lips for the first time, she replied quietly, but with dignity, that it was not the wont of the daughters of her people to uncover their faces when alone in an assembly of strangers. The sweet tones of her voice and the softness of her reply impressed on the audience a sentiment of pity and sympathy. But Beaumanoir, in whose mind the suppression of each feeling of humanity which could interfere with his imagined duty was a virtue of itself, repeated his commands that his victim should be unveiled. The guards were about to remove her veil accordingly when she stood up before the Grand Master and said,
"Nay, but for the love of your own daughters." "Alas," she said, recollecting herself, "ye have no daughters, but for the remembrance of your mothers, for the love of your sisters, and of female decency, let me not be mishandled in your presence. It suits not a maiden to be disrobed by such rude grooms." "I will obey you," she added, with an expression of patient sorrow in her voice, which had almost melted the heart of Beaumanoir himself. Ye are elders among your people, and at your command I will show the features of an ill-fated maiden.
She withdrew her veil, and looked on them with a countenance in which bashfulness contended with dignity. Her exceeding beauty excited a murmur of surprise, and the younger knights told each other with their eyes, in stolen correspondence, that Brienne's best apology was in the power of her real charms rather than of her imaginary witchcraft. But Hig, the son of Snell, felt most deeply the effect produced by the sight of the countenance of his benefactress.
"Let me go forth," he cried to the warders at the door of the hall. "Let me go forth! To look on her again will kill me, as I've had a share in murdering her."
"Peace, poor man," said Rebecca, when she heard his exclamation. "Thou hast done me no harm by speaking the truth. Thou canst not aid me by thy complaints or lamentations. Peace, I pray thee. Go home and save thyself."
Hig was about to be thrust out by the compassion of the warders, who were apprehensive lest his clamorous grief should draw upon them reprehension and upon himself punishment. But he promised to be silent and was permitted to remain. The two men-at-arms, with whom Albert Malvoisin had not failed to communicate upon the import of their testimony, were now called forward. Though both were hardened and inflexible villains, the sight of the captive maiden, as well as her exceeding beauty, at the first appeared to stagger them, but an expressive glance from the preceptor of Templestowe restored them to their dogged composure, and they delivered, with a precision which would have seemed suspicious to more favourable judges, circumstances either altogether fictitious or trivial and natural in themselves, but rendered pregnant with suspicion by the exaggerated manner in which they were told and the sinister commentary which the witnesses added to the facts. The circumstances of their evidence would have been in modern days divided into two classes, those which were immaterial and those which were actually and physically impossible. But both were, in those ignorant and superstitious days, eagerly credited as proofs of guilt. That Rebecca was heard to mutter to herself in an unknown tongue, that the songs she sung by fits were of a strangely sweet sound, which made the ears of the listener tingle and his heart throb, that she spoke at times to herself and seemed to look upward for a reply, that her garments were of a strange and mystic form, unlike those of other women of good, that she had rings impressed with cabalistical devices, and that strange characters were broidered on her veil. All these circumstances, so natural and trivial, were gravely listened to as proofs, or at least as affording strong suspicions, that Rebecca had unlawful correspondence with mystical powers. But there was less equivocal testimony, which the credulity of the assembly, or of the greater part, greedily swallowed, however incredible. One of the soldiers had seen her work a cure upon a wounded man brought with them to the castle of Torquilstone. She did, he said, make certain signs upon the wound, and repeated certain mysterious words, which he blessed God he understood not. When the iron head of a square crossbow bolt disengaged itself from the wound, the bleeding was staunched, the wound was closed, and the dying man was, within the quarter of an hour, walking upon the ramparts, and assisting the witness in managing a mangonel, or machine for hurling stones. This legend was probably founded on the fact that Rebecca had attended on the wounded Ivanhoe when in the castle of Torquilstone. But it was the more difficult to dispute the accuracy of the witness, as, in order to produce real evidence in support of his verbal testimony, he drew from his pouch the very bolt head which, according to his story, had been thus miraculously extracted from the wound, and, as the iron weighed a full ounce, it completely confirmed the tale, however marvellous. His comrade had been a witness from a neighbouring battlement of the scene betwixt Rebecca and Bois Guilbert, when she was upon the point of precipitating herself from the top of the tower.
Not to be behind his companion, this fellow stated that he had seen Rebecca perch herself on the parapet of the turret and there take the form of a milk-white swan, under which appearance she flitted three times round the castle of Torquilstone, then again settled on the turret and assumed once more the female form. Less than one half of this weighty evidence would have been sufficient to convict any old woman, poor and ugly, even though she had not been a Jewess. United with that fatal circumstance, the body of proof was too weighty for Rebecca's youth, even when united with the most exquisite beauty. The Grand Master had collected the suffrages, and now, in a solemn tone, demanded of Rebecca what she had to say against the sentence of condemnation which he was about to pronounce. "To invoke your pity," said the lovely Jewess, with a voice somewhat tremulous with emotion, "would, I am aware, be as useless as I should hold it mean. To state that to relieve the sick and wounded of another religion cannot be displeasing to the acknowledged founder of both our faiths were also unavailing. To plead that many things which these men, whom may heaven pardon, have spoken against me are impossible, would avail me but little, since you believe in their possibility. And still less would it advantage me to explain that the peculiarities of my dress, language, and manners are those of my people, I had well nigh said of my country, but, alas, we have no country. Nor will I even vindicate myself at the expense of my oppressor, who stands there listening to the fictions and surmises which seem to convert the tyrant into the victim, God be judge betwixt him and me, but rather would I submit to 10 such deaths as your pleasure denounces against me than listen to the suit which that man of Belial has urged upon me, friendless, defenseless, and his prisoner. But he is of your own faith, and his lightest affirmance would weigh down the most solemn protestations of the distressed Jewess. I will not therefore return to himself the charge brought against me, but to himself, yes, Brian de Bois-Guilbert, to thyself I appeal, whether these accusations are not false, as monstrous and calumnious as they are deadly." There was a pause. All eyes turned to Brian de Bois-Guilbert. He was silent. "Speak," she said. "If thou art a man, if thou art a Christian, speak. I conjure thee by the cross which thou dost wear, by the name thou didst inherit, by the knighthood thou didst vaunt, by the honour of thy mother, by the tomb and the bones of thy father, I conjure thee to say, are these things true?"
"Answer her, brother," said the Grand Master. "If the enemy with whom thou dost wrestle will give thee power."
In fact, Bois-Guilbert seemed agitated by contending passions, which almost convulsed his features, and it was with a constrained voice that at length he replied, looking to Rebecca,
"The scroll! The scroll!"
"Aye," said Beaumanoir, "this is indeed testimony. The victim of her witcheries can only name the fatal scroll, which is doubtless the cause of his silence."
But Rebecca put another interpretation on the words extorted, as it were, from Bois-Guilbert, and glancing her eye upon the slip of parchment which she continued to hold in her hand, she read thereupon, in the Arabian character, "Demand a champion." The murmuring commentary which ran through the assembly at the strange reply of Bois-Guilbert gave Rebecca leisure to examine and instantly to destroy the scroll, as she thought, unobserved. When the whisper had ceased, the Grand Master spoke.
"Rebecca, thou canst derive no benefit from the evidence of this unhappy knight, for whom, as we well perceive, the enemy is yet too powerful. Hast thou aught else to say?"
"There is yet one chance of life left to me," said Rebecca, "even by your own fierce laws. Life has been miserable, miserable at least of late, but I will not cast away the gift of God while he affords me the means of defending it. I deny this charge. I maintain my innocence, and I declare the falsehood of this accusation. I challenge the privilege of trial by combat, and will appear by my champion.
And who, Rebecca, replied the Grand Master, will lay lance in rest for a sorceress? Who will be the champion of a Jewess?
God will raise me up a champion, said Rebecca. It cannot be that in merry England, the hospitable, the generous, the free, where so many are ready to peril their lives for honour, there shall not be found one to fight for justice. But it is enough that I challenge the trial by combat. There lies my gage. She took her embroidered glove from her hand and flung it down before the Grand Master with an air of mingled simplicity and dignity, which excited universal surprise and admiration. Chapter 8.
There I throw my gage, to prove it on thee to the extremest point of martial daring.
Richard II.
Even Luca Beaumanoir himself was affected by the mien and appearance of Rebecca. He was not originally a cruel or even a severe man, but with passions by nature cold, and with a high, though mistaken, sense of duty, his heart had been gradually hardened by the ascetic life which he pursued, the supreme power which he enjoyed, and the supposed necessity of subduing infidelity and eradicating heresy, which he conceived peculiarly incumbent on him. His features relaxed in their usual severity as he gazed upon the beautiful creature before him, alone, unfriended, and defending herself with so much spirit and courage. He crossed himself twice, as doubting whence arose the unwonted softening of a heart, which on such occasions was wont to resemble in hardness the steel of his sword. At length he spoke.
"Damsel," he said, "if the pity I feel for thee arise from any practice thine evil arts have made on me, great is thy guilt. But I rather judge it the kinder feelings of nature, which grieves that so goodly a form should be a vessel of perdition. Repent, O my daughter, confess thy witchcrafts, turn thee from thine evil faith, embrace this holy emblem, and all shall yet be well with thee here and hereafter. In some sisterhood of the strictest order shalt thou have time for prayer and fitting penance, and that repentance not to be repented of. This do and live. What has the law of Moses done for thee that thou shouldst die for it?"
"It was the law of my fathers," said Rebecca. "It was delivered in thunders and in storms upon the mountain of Sinai, in cloud and in fire. This, if you are Christians, you believe. It is, you say, recalled, but so my teachers have not taught me."
"Let our chaplain," said Beaumanoir, "stand forth and tell this obstinate infidel."
"Forgive the interruption," said Rebecca meekly. "I am a maiden, unskilled to dispute for my religion, but I can die for it, if it be God's will. Let me pray your answer to my demand of a champion."
"Give me her glove," said Beaumanoir. "This is indeed," he continued, as he looked at the flimsy texture and slender fingers, "a slight and frail gage for a purpose so deadly. Seest thou, Rebecca, as this thin and light glove of thine is to one of our heavy steel gauntlets, so is thy cause to that of the temple, for it is our order which thou hast defied."
"Cast my innocence into the scale," answered Rebecca, "and the glove of silk shall outweigh the glove of iron."
"Then thou dost persist in thy refusal to confess thy guilt, and in that bold challenge which thou hast made?"
"I do persist, noble sir," answered Rebecca.
"So be it then, in the name of heaven," said the Grand Master, "and may God show the right."
"Amen," replied the preceptors around him, and the word was deeply echoed by the whole assembly.
"Brethren," resumed Beaumanoir, "ye are aware that we might well have refused to this woman the benefit of the trial by combat. But though a Jewess and an unbeliever, she is also a stranger and defenceless.
and God forbid that she should ask the benefit of our mild laws, and that it should be refused to her. Moreover, we are knights and soldiers, as well as men of religion, and shame it were to us upon any pretense to refuse proffered combat. Thus, therefore, stands the case. Rebecca, the daughter of Isaac of York, is, by many pregnant and suspicious circumstances, defamed of sorcery practiced on the person of a noble knight of our holy order, and hath challenged the combat in proof of her innocence. To whom, reverend brethren, is it your opinion that we should deliver this her gage of battle, naming him at the same time to be our champion in the field?
To Brian de Bois-Guilbert, whom it chiefly concerns, answered the preceptor of Goodalric, and who, moreover, best knows how the truth stands in this matter. But if, said the Grand Master, our brother Brian be under the influence of a charm or a spell, we speak but for the sake of precaution, for to the arm of none of our holy order would we more willingly confide this or a more weighty cause.
Reverend Father, answered the preceptor of Goodalric, no spell can affect the champion who comes forward to fight for the judgment of God.
Thou sayest right, brother, said the Grand Master. Albert Malvoisin, give this gage of battle to Brian de Bois-Guilbert. It is our charge to thee, brother, he continued, addressing himself to Bois-Guilbert, that thou do this battle manfully, nothing doubting that thy good cause shall triumph. And do thou, Rebecca, attend, that we assign thee the third day from the present to find a champion.
That is but brief space, answered Rebecca, for a stranger, and one of another faith, to find one who will do battle, wagering life and honour for her cause.
We may not extend it, answered the Grand Master. The field must be foughten in our own presence, and divers weighty causes call us on the fourth day from hence.
God's will be done, said Rebecca. I put my trust in him to whom an instant is as effectual to save as a whole age.
Thou hast spoken well, damsel, replied the Grand Master, but well know we who can array himself like an angel of light. It remains but to name a convenient and fitting place of combat, and, if it shall so hap, also of execution. Where is the preceptor of this house?
Albert Malvoisin, still holding Rebecca's glove in his hand, was speaking to Bois-Guilbert very earnestly, but in a low voice.
How? Said the Grand Master. Will he not receive the gage?
He will. He doth, most reverend father, said Malvoisin, slipping the glove under his own mantle. And for the place of combat, I hold the fittest to be the lists of St. George, belonging to this preceptory, and used by us for military exercise.
It is well, said the Grand Master. Rebecca, in those lists shalt thou produce thy champion. And if thou failest to do so, or if thy champion shall be discomfited by the judgment of God, thou shalt then die the death of a sorceress according to doom. Let this our judgment be recorded, and the record read aloud, that no one may pretend ignorance.
One of the chaplains, who acted as clerks to the chapter, immediately engrossed the order in a huge volume, which contained the proceedings of the Templar knights when solemnly assembled upon such occasions, and when he had finished writing, the other read aloud the sentence of the Grand Master, which, when translated from the Norman French in which it was couched, was expressed as follows. Rebecca, a Jewess, daughter of Isaac of York, being attainted of sorcery, seduction, and other damnable practices, practiced on a knight of the most holy order of the Temple of Zion, doth deny the same, and saith that the testimony delivered against her this day is false, wicked, and disloyal, and that by lawful esuan of her body, as being unable to combat in her own behalf, she doth offer, by a gentleman instead thereof, to avouch her case, he performing his loyal devoir in all knightly sort, with such arms as to gage of battle do fitly appertain, and that at her peril and cost. And therewith she proffered her gage. And the gage having been delivered to the noble lord and knight Brian de Bois-Guilbert of the Holy Order of the Temple of Zion, he was appointed to do this battle in behalf of his order and himself,
as injured and impaired by the practices of the said appellant. Whereupon the most reverend father and puissant lord, Luca, Marquis of Beaumanoir, did allow of the said challenge, and of the said Eswan of the appellant's body, and assigned the third day for the said combat, the place being the enclosure called the Lists of St. George, near to the preceptory of Templestowe. And the Grand Master appoints the appellant to appear there by her champion, on pain of doom, as a person convicted of sorcery or seduction, and also the defendant so to appear, under the penalty of being held and adjudged recreant in case of default, and the noble lord and most reverend father aforesaid appointeth the battle to be done in his own presence, and according to all that is commendable and profitable in such a case, and may God aid the just cause. Amen, said the Grand Master, and his word was echoed by all around. Rebecca spoke not, but she looked up to heaven, and folding her hands remained for a minute without change of attitude. She then modestly reminded the Grand Master that she ought to be permitted some opportunity of free communication with her friends for the purpose of making her condition known to them, and procuring, if possible, some champion to fight in her behalf. "It is just and lawful," said the Grand Master. "Choose what messenger thou wilt trust, and he shall have free communication with thee in thy prison chamber."
"Is there," said Rebecca, "anyone here who, either for love of a good cause or for an ample hire, will do the errand of a distressed being?"
All were silent, for none thought it safe, in the presence of the Grand Master, to avow any interest in the calumniated prisoner, lest he should be suspected of a leaning towards Judaism. Not even the prospect of reward, far less any feelings of compassion alone, could surmount this apprehension. Rebecca stood for a few minutes in indescribable anxiety, and then exclaimed,
"Is it really thus?
And in this English land, am I to be deprived of the poor chance of safety which remains to me for want of an act of charity which would not be refused to the worst criminal?" Hig, the son of Snell, at length replied,
"I am but a maimed man, but that I can at all stir or move was owing to her charitable assistance. I will do thine errand," he added, addressing Rebecca, "as well as a crippled object can, and happy were my limbs fleet enough to repair the mischief done by my tongue. Alas, when I boasted of thy charity, I little thought I was leading thee into danger."
"God," said Rebecca, "is the disposer of all. He can turn back the captivity of Judah even by the weakest instrument. To execute his errand, the snail is as sure a messenger as the falcon. Seek out Isaac of York. Here is that will pay for horse and man, and let him have this scroll. I know not if it be of heaven, the spirit which inspires me, but most truly do I judge that I am not to die this death, and that a champion will be raised up for me. Farewell. Life and death are in thy haste." The peasant took the scroll, which contained only a few words in Hebrew. Many of the crowd would have dissuaded him from touching a document so suspicious, but Hig was resolute in the service of his benefactress. She had saved his body, he said, and he was confident that she did not mean to peril his soul.
"I will get me," he said, "my neighbour Boothan's good capel, and I will be at York within as brief space as man and beast may."
But, as it fortuned, he had no occasion to go so far, for within a quarter of a mile from the gate of the preceptory he met with two riders, whom by their dress and their huge yellow caps he knew to be Jews, and on approaching more nearly, discovered that one of them was his ancient employer, Isaac of York. The other was the Rabbi Ben Samuel, and both had approached as near to the preceptory as they dared, on hearing that the Grand Master had summoned a chapter for the trial of a sorceress.
"Brother Ben Samuel," said Isaac, "my soul is disquieted, and I wot not why. This charge of necromancy is right often used for cloaking evil practices on our people."
"Be of good comfort, brother," said the physician.
thou canst deal with the Nazarenes as one possessing the mammon of unrighteousness, and canst therefore purchase immunity at their hands. It rules the savage minds of these ungodly men, even as the signet of the mighty Solomon was said to command the evil genii. But what poor wretch comes hither upon his crutches, desiring, as I think, some speech with me? Friend, continued the physician, addressing Hig the son of Snell, I refuse thee not the aid of mine art, but I relieve not with one asper those who beg for alms on the highway. Out upon thee! Hast thou the palsy in thy legs? Then let thy hands work for thy livelihood, for, albeit thou beest unfit for a speedy post, or for a careful shepherd, or for the warfare, or for the service of a hasty master, yet there be occupations. How now, brother? Said he, interrupting his harangue to look towards Isaac, who had but glanced at the scroll which Hig offered, when, uttering a deep groan, he fell from his mule like a dying man, and lay for a minute insensible. The rabbi now dismounted in great alarm, and hastily applied the remedies which his art suggested for the recovery of his companion. He had even taken from his pocket a cupping apparatus, and was about to proceed to phlebotomy, when the object of his anxious solicitude suddenly revived. But it was to dash his cap from his head, and to throw dust on his grey hairs. The physician was at first inclined to ascribe this sudden and violent emotion to the effects of insanity, and, adhering to his original purpose, began once again to handle his instruments, but Isaac soon convinced him of his error.
"Child of my sorrow," he said, "well shouldst thou be called Benoni instead of Rebecca. Why should thy death bring down my grey hairs to the grave, till in the bitterness of my heart I curse God and die?"
"Brother," said the rabbi in great surprise, "art thou a father in Israel, and dost thou utter words like unto these? I trust that the child of thy house yet liveth."
"She liveth," answered Isaac, "but it is as Daniel, which was called Belteshazzar, even when within the den of the lions. She is captive unto those men of Belial, and they will wreak their cruelty upon her, sparing neither for her youth nor her comely favour. Oh, she was as a crown of green palms to my grey locks, and she must wither in a night like the gourd of Jonah. Child of my love, child of my old age, oh, Rebecca, daughter of Rachel, the darkness of the shadow of death hath encompassed thee."
"Yet read the scroll," said the rabbi. "Peradventure we may yet find out a way of deliverance."
"Do thou read, brother," answered Isaac, "for mine eyes are as fountains of water."
The physician read, but in their native language, the following words:
"To Isaac, the son of Adonikam, whom the Gentiles call Isaac of York, peace and the blessing of the promise be multiplied upon thee. My father, I am as one doomed to die for that which my soul knoweth not, even for the crime of witchcraft. My father, if a strong man can be found to do battle for my cause with sword and spear, according to the custom of the Nazarenes, and that within the lists of Templestowe, on the third day from this time, peradventure our father's God will give him strength to defend the innocent, and her who hath none to help her. But if this may not be, let the virgins of our people mourn for me as for one cast off, and for the heart that is stricken by the hunter, and for the flower which is cut down by the scythe of the mower. Wherefore, look now what thou doest, and whether there be any rescue. One Nazarene warrior might indeed bear arms in my behalf, even Wilfred, son of Cedric, whom the Gentiles call Ivanhoe. But he may not yet endure the weight of his armour. Nevertheless, send the tidings unto him, my father, for he hath favour among the strong men of his people, and as he was our companion in the house of bondage, he may find someone to do battle for my sake. And say unto him, even unto Wilfred the son of Cedric, that if Rebecca live, or if Rebecca die,
she liveth or dieth wholly free of the guilt she is charged withal. And if it be the will of God that thou shalt be deprived of thy daughter, do not thou tarry, old man, in this land of bloodshed and cruelty, but betake thyself to Cordova, where thy brother liveth in safety, under the shadow of the throne, even of the throne of Boabdil the Saracen, for less cruel are the cruelties of the Moors unto the race of Jacob than the cruelties of the Nazarenes of England. Isaac listened with tolerable composure while Ben Samuel read the letter, and then again resumed